You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. Coming up, we'll hear live coverage of Governor Walker's budget address and then take a look at some of the big news items in his budget plan.
First, climate change continues to be a big story in state and national news. We hear about climate data taken off the state DNR website, federal cabinet nominees questioned on their climate change positions, and now a federal agency under fire over at how it handles temperature readings from decades ago. But when it comes to the basics of climate science and research, what do we know, and how do we know it?
Joining us to discuss research into climate change and what trends we're seeing in Wisconsin is Dan Bimont. He's an associate professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison and co-chair of the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts. Dan, thanks for being here.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Well, from a scientific perspective, let's start with the freshest information that scientists know. What do we know right now about climate change and what is going on with temperatures?
That's a good question. So right now, we're coming off of the warmest year on record. 2016 was the warmest year on record, which beat 2015 as the warmest year on record prior to that. And those 2 years are notable not only because of this long-term trend that we're seeing in warming, but also because they were large El Nino events. And so a lot of the warming that we've seen for these 2 years in particular can be attributed to these El Nino events on top of a slowly warming global climate.
But scientists take El Nino events into account as they look at these long-term trends. Is that right?
Absolutely. El Nino is a big big form of natural variability in our climate system. In fact, it's the largest thing that can happen to our climate system other than just the annual cycle. And so when we look at long-term warming, we do take into account these kinds of variations.
And according to the Nelson Institute, 15 of the 16 warmest years on record have come since 2001. How far back do these temperature records go, and what is the scientific protocol and how you keep these records?
These records go back to about the 1800s, the mid-1800s for some data. But data coverage gets more and more sparse as you get really far back. And so we feel pretty comfortable with global temperature records back from, say, the mid to late 1800s. And then moving forward, prior to that, coverage just isn't good enough, and we just don't have the data for that.
And are there, as you go back decades and centuries, are there different ways to determine temperatures or how scientists did things in their procedure of recording temperature?
Yes, and this has been in the news quite a bit in the last few months with the recalculation of historical temperatures from the NOAA.
National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
That's right, from the National Climatic Data Center, which I believe has a new acronym to it now. I have trouble keeping up with all the changing alphabet soup here. But so the way that we've measured temperatures has evolved with technology. And so prior to World War II, most temperature records were, most temperatures over in the ocean were measured actually by a bucket method. So you grab a bucket of water, you bring it up, and you take the temperature of the bucket of water. The problem is that as you're bringing that bucket up to the ship, a little bit of evaporation occurs, which cools the water. And so earlier records would correct for that prior to World War II. And one of the big findings in the recent recalculation was that that still makes a big difference. There's still a lot of ships that are taking temperature records from buckets, which is fine. It's just that we need to correct for it in the actual global temperature records.
It seems like it would be a minuscule amount.
It's on the order of a tenth of a degree. And so that's,
but that matters.
That matters a lot, right? Uh-huh. Because that's a decade worth of warming or so. So that's a big number. When you're talking on these global trends, it's a slow warming trend. But when you average over the whole globe, it's a big deal.
And we're hearing reports of a massive and rapidly growing crack in an Antarctic ice shelf and an iceberg the size of Delaware. What can you tell us about this and climate change?
Yeah, that's an area I'm not tremendously familiar with. However, I mean, we're seeing just some amazing changes in the Arctic and Antarctic this year. Sea ice. There's a big difference between sea ice and sea. Sea ice has reached record minimum extents, and what's strange is that that's occurring at a time of year that usually there's a lot of recovery of sea ice. So it's not just the end of the summer season in the Northern Hemisphere, for example. Temperatures in the Arctic have been just astronomically warm, and that's a current research issue that we're, as a climate science community, trying to identify, you know, what are the causes of that and what are the potential implications of that warming in the Arctic region. So we're seeing we're seeing some amazing things this year that we need some answers in theory for.
We're talking with Dan Vimont. He's a professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison, the director of the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research, and co-chair of the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts. And so sea level rise as well here, occurring at twice the global average and at the highest rate along the Atlantic coast. Can you unpack this for us? What does this mean in our real life here?
Sea levels is far more interesting than it may seem. So one of the actually, so my apologies to anyone who actually studies sea level out there. It's it seems very interesting to me, at least. Sea level rise can occur for two main reasons. One is if there is a loss of land ice, a melting of ice on land that would then run off into the ocean. And the other reason that sea level will be rising is just as water warms, it expands, and therefore you end up with higher sea levels. And what's interesting is that the spatial distribution of sea level rise is not uniform. If you just dump a bunch more water into the ocean, or if you warm the ocean uniformly, the change in sea level is not uniform. And that's due to the way that these large ice sheets affect our gravitational field. And so you end up with changes that can be very different and regionally dependent. That has there are huge implications for this on the East Coast. I think I heard recently that if the sanitation or the sewer system in D.C., were to get flooded, which it gets close occasionally. If it were to flood out, then D.C. would be without sanitary sewer for 3 months. Mm. And the implications of something like that are enormous. And you know, the writing is on the wall that in the next century we should see anywhere between 1 foot and 4 feet of sea level rise. So this is going to be a major issue.
And skeptics of climate change, they often cite natural variations in the Earth's climate as a reason for the rising temperature and atmospheric conditions that we're seeing. Based on your modeling, is it possible to explain climate change without the effect of humans?
Not on the timescale that we've seen. And that's what the big difference is here. We certainly take climate variations into effect. That's actually my major area of research. I got into climate change after that. But if we run models with the observed change in human-induced greenhouse gases and without human-induced greenhouse gases, then we cannot reproduce the warming that we've observed unless we include the anthropogenic, so human-caused, greenhouse gas changes that we've observed in the last, 100 years or so.
But still, there is such this heated debate that it's not happening.
Well, that debate isn't really happening in scientific circles.
Okay.
And that's a key distinction I like to make here. There's two issues related to climate change. One, the science of climate change. And then the other, what do we do about it? The former is a scientific process. It's a bunch of scientists discussing and so forth. It's thermometers, right? It's hard to argue with a thermometer. The other is a political process. What do we do about it? How do we reduce the amount of climate change? How much should we plan on reducing climate change? How much should we plan on adapting? Those two questions are both necessary because we're beyond the point where we're going to stop climate change or even, you know, even stopping at a dangerous level is going to require a lot of work. And so we need to be prepared for an adaptation as well.
We're talking with Dan Bimont, the co-chair of the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts, about the current state of climate science and what climate change means for life in Wisconsin.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about climate change science and research? Do you think climate change is a serious problem and that people are making it worse? Or do you still have doubts about the role humans are playing in the environment? What kind of policies do you want to see at the federal or state levels when it comes to the climate? And what do you want to know about how it might affect us here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the current state of climate science, what we know, how we know it, and its impact on life here in Wisconsin. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Are you curious about how climate scientists come up with their information and predictions? Is climate change something you think about? Do you live in an area or work in an industry that has been affected by climate change? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Dan Bimont stays with us. He's a professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison and co-chair of the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts.
And Dan, getting back to our conversation here, focusing a moment on Wisconsin, how have changes in Wisconsin's climate and the environment here compared to the rest of the country and perhaps around the world?
Changes here in Wisconsin have been pretty comparable to the rest of the country and the rest of the world. Globally, the climate has warmed by about a degree and a half Fahrenheit in the last 115-20 years, whatever. Since about 1950, we've observed about the same here in Wisconsin. That warming has been more pronounced in wintertime than summertime, which is an interesting question in itself. And it's also consistent with our projections forward, which is based on independent information. The projections forward on climate change suggest that winter will warm more than summer. That nighttime low temperatures will warm more than daytime high temperatures. And so those kinds of changes that we've observed are very consistent with what you might expect due to anthropogenic climate change.
What does that mean for Wisconsin lakes? What does that mean for, you know, in just how we go about our lives season to season and do what we do here in Wisconsin?
That is a really complicated question, it turns out, because all of us are so diverse. We have so many different interests. And so, you know, a few things that this means is that, so for example, warm temperatures are not good for trout. And so trout habitat is likely to decrease considerably. In the DNR, the Driftless area, people are working on looking at where trout refugia may be. We will see shifts in forest composition. One species is paper birch. We might see a loss of paper birch in northern Wisconsin. Lake temperatures could be warming, and there's some interesting effects that occur based on the size of the lake, that small lakes tend to be a little more sheltered from some mixing processes. And so it may depend on the size of the lake. Increased heat waves, which are the biggest cause of mortality from natural disasters in Wisconsin. More people have died from heat waves in Wisconsin than every other natural disaster combined, which surprised me. I didn't realize that. But heat waves are expected to triple in frequency and increase in intensity as well. So there's a whole variety depending on what we are. Depending on your interests, right? What you care about.
Let's take a call now. Harry from Madison. Hi, Harry.
Good afternoon. I don't know if Dan has gotten to this or not. I had a climate science course last semester, so I know enough to be dangerous. But I really welcome his comments on the oceans. According to the course material that came from NASA, the oceans serve as carbon sinks. And as that carbon has built up over eons, they reach a capacity level. And, of course, as the water warms, the amount of carbon it can retain also declines. So I think that's maybe an unmentioned story, generally speaking. And this feeds into the second part of my question about the Arctic Ocean ice. There's a lot of talk about how far the ice goes, the extent of the ice, but there seems to be very little commentary about the volume, the thickness of the ice, which has been declining for decades. So that if you were to take that square mile area and then consider the thickness of the ice, the diminishment of the ice is even more dramatic than most people realize.
Wow, great question there, Harry. Thanks. The first part of that, you're absolutely correct. As the oceans warm, they become less able to absorb carbon from the atmosphere. Currently, about half of what we put into the atmosphere gets absorbed by either the ocean or land. How the ocean takes that up is actually a really interesting process. That's affected by the temperature of the ocean. And it's also affected by, to a certain extent, the acidity of the ocean, which increases with more carbon dioxide that gets absorbed, more carbon that gets absorbed. I don't think we're at a point yet where the ocean is going to stop taking up carbon, but it's currently taking about a quarter of what we put in, but that will diminish in the future, most likely.
All right. Well, thank you, Harry, for your insights. Matt from Madison. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how's it going?
Great. What would you like to add?
I was curious how farming, and in particular cow farming, and I guess the food industry in general, has an impact on climate change and what we could or do about it and why maybe that's not happening.
Wow. The last part of that is the really tricky one, why that's not happening. Farming does can have an impact on climate change in either way. I think sequestering carbon down into the soil and regrowth of vegetation can actually remove carbon from the atmosphere. But at the same time, nitrous oxides are important greenhouse gases, and those can be byproducts of fertilization and so forth. Also methane in terms of animal farming, so it does have an effect. What we can do about it, I think there's a lot of research going on both at the University of Wisconsin here and around the country, looking at how to sequester some of those gases, and how to potentially even use, in the case of methane, there's a great example of that in the Driftless area with capturing methane and then using it for community, energy source.
Yeah. Thank you, Matt. Let's go to Chuck in Lilly. Hi, Chuck.
Yeah, hi. My question is what's been the consideration of human-created heat from the millions of automobiles we run? Every machine we operate generates heat. My house is bleeding heat into the environment as well as every other dwelling in the world. What's been considered the impact of that on the rising temperatures?
Good question. There's two ways to answer that. One is the direct effect of that energy. And when you burn, say, a ton of coal or something, you emit carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but you also produce a lot of energy. And it turns out that once you put that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and that carbon dioxide sticks around for 50 or 100 years, it has thousands of times the warming potential of the actual burning of the coal itself, which surprised me when I first calculated that. It was the effect of the carbon as a greenhouse gas is far more intense than the actual warming that you get from burning the coal. But the second part of that is that as we've changed our environment, as we've built more urban environments and so forth, we create what's called an urban heat island effect, where urban areas with more concrete and so forth stay warmer and warm up more during the day. And that can exacerbate some of the effects of climate change. And there's some good research going on here at University of Wisconsin looking at the effect of urban heat island effects.
Well, thank you, Chuck, for your call. Margaret now in Sun Prairie. Hi, Margaret.
Hi there. I'm very interested in the aspect of farming, and the question a while ago as to why it's not happening is very pertinent to me. I'm a follower of Joel Salatin, who is a mob grazer, and he believes that we can sink the carbon into the ground if more people farmed his way, which is cover cropping. And he believes, too, that we can decrease the carbon in the atmosphere to pre-industrial levels if we were to cover the ground, which, of course, isn't done in the United States with all these row cropping and monocropping.
So that's certainly the research I've seen on cover cropping and also no-till has a huge effect on soil quality and so forth. The one thing that I do want to caution on, though, is that there is no one solution for this, and that can help. It absolutely helps. And I want to applaud you for those kind of practices, because all of us working together, doing whatever we can, is what's going to help. And any individual action is probably not going to be enough. And that's kind of a frightening state of affairs, but it's also an important one for all of us to keep in mind. So thanks for doing what you're doing.
And any final thoughts here as we wrap up very quickly? What can Wisconsinites do to fight climate change in our own lives every day?
I think we need to be aware of it and cognizant of it. It's, you know, and oftentimes sometimes I feel like climate change sounds doom and gloom, and I keep reminding people, you know, especially in my classes, you will fall in love. You will be amazed by places in this world. You will do great things in your lives. It's just we're going to do that within a warming climate. So be aware.
Dan, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thanks a lot.
That was Dan Vimond, Associate Professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison and the co-chair of the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is Central Time.